This is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we have very special guest Kelsey Dione, creator of the award-winning Shadow Dark game. You know, it's one of the most successful role-playing games in recent years, and since we enjoy both old games and new, we kind of love it. We'll get the inside scoop from Kelsey and a whole lot more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get started today, I'll just remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. That's a live video chat that Dan and I host on our Discord server, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Get your account all set up over there before the end of the show, and maybe about 10 minutes or so after the end of the show, Dan and I will be there to talk to you all live.
We love that part of our week. You know, maybe we'll get Kelsey to drop in on that for a couple minutes. So check in on our Discord server if you're patrons afterwards. Kelsey, you know, we have been looking forward to speaking with you for some time. We are absolutely delighted that you could find some time out of your busy schedule to join us here this Sunday. So thank you so much for being here.
Oh my gosh, thanks for having me. I know we were going, we had quite an effort to schedule it because of me being a diva. No, I've been doing such intense like Kickstarter production stuff that this is actually my first reappearance on the internet in like a year. So I'm grateful that it gets to be with you guys. Yeah.
Wow.
We are on YouTube and stuff.
Let me say just out of the box that when I read Shadow Dark, and for on my end, I've been mostly reading the Quick Start rules here. There's so many innovations there that I have also used in my own D&D games for a number of years. And that includes stuff like the real time passing is game time. That's how I've done Wandering Monsters for years. The initiative around the table, which I've never actually seen, you know, Paul and I both do that. I've never seen that written in a rule book, a bunch of mechanical simplifications. So page after page, I'm just like, these are really good decisions. And so in some ways, it's almost kind of uncanny. I will also point out to the viewers that the three of us did not coordinate our shirts today. We just happened to be on the same wavelength. That we coincidentally all dressed exactly the same. And I feel like that underlines that we're kind of on the same wavelengths. So I feel like that's where I'm coming from for the interview today.
I just noticed that. I didn't even realize. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. And Dan, thank you. And I have to give so much credit for a lot of the stuff in Shadow Dark is sort of, it's like stuff that's like either bubbled up in the general OSR like homebrew hacking space, or like in the case of Around the Table Initiative, like that's originally from like, I mean, that's kind of from the board game space and stuff, but the first time I ever saw that written in a rule book was actually in the game Index Card RPG by Runehammer Games. So I was so convinced of how well it worked in that game that I was like, I can't not do it this way in my own, you know. So yeah.
Going around the table, I think, is my personal favorite, just because like, it's just then so easy to look and see who's coming next. You just immediately know when your turn's coming up. I really enjoyed your innovation, though, of like still having a roll at the beginning to kind of offset where we start on the table. I've not seen that one, and I thought that was very clever.
Agreed.
Thank you. That is fun. One thing I started doing, too, I sometimes do this at cons, is we'll roll it, and then the person who wins initiative decides the order that we go around the table. So sometimes we're like changing direction, which kind of shakes it up a little, and it's a little bit of a tactical decision, so that can be kind of fun.
Dan has done the, like, if you want to get up and move your seat, that's allowed.
Yeah, totally fair. It's actually smart. It's smart to do it, because, like, people pick up on the fact that, like, oh, you want to place your highest dex character in a strategic location, and, like, that's totally fair to do. Yeah.
Yeah, that's we've enjoyed it. So I got to ask Kelsey, how, and normally I ask most folks this, like I'm honestly a little surprised that someone of such tender years as yourself has such great instincts for old school kind of dark fantasy gaming. So how did you personally get into the hobby? What games, what editions, what are your major influences for your fantasy gaming?
You're so kind to imply that I'm young because I'm almost 40, but I'm in my late 30s, so I'm just trying to get used to saying I'm 40. But I'm very fortunate. I kind of have to blame like luck and location from my childhood because I grew up in southern Wisconsin. I'm from Wisconsin, and this was in the 90s during the TSR era. So you know, like Lake Geneva was like, you know, 30, 45 minutes south from where I grew up. And there was a ton of gaming culture. Yeah. Like in my hometown. And so, I like D&D was just kind of a part of the, like the Madison area's like nerd cultural fabric. It was very strong there. And so I was a little bit of a nerd as a kid and just gravitated towards that hobby. And so by the time I was in, you know, fifth, sixth grade, I was going to the local game store in my hometown every Saturday and playing D&D with like people who either worked at TSR or were playing in Gary Gygax's weekly game. Oh, wow. And they were running like old school, like judges. It was a guy named James Mishler actually was like wrangling the pack of D&D aspirants at that game store. So he'd show up every Saturday and do his like community service of teaching the next generation how to play. And he was lovely. And he was running us through City State of the Invincible Overlord, which is a really old school, like Judges Guild setting. And so I feel like I was just steeped in sort of the old school methods because of that. I was very lucky.
Wow. Tap pretty close to the source. Wow, that's fantastic.
Somehow, we didn't realize how special that was when we were kids. Like, we had no idea how lucky we were. And then it's just, like, Gary Gygax came to visit the store and stuff. And, like, I got to meet him in person. And to be that close to the heart of the game was very fortunate. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Okay, second question. And my second question is, I think that before Shadow Dark, I think you were writing some fifth edition adventures that looked to my eye to be all horror themed. So on your website there at the Arcane Library, you've got for fifth edition, you've got Bundle of Horror 1, Bundle of Horror 2, you've got the Demons and Devils adventures. And I've said, you know, Paul runs a lot of horror games. And in fact, he has his own indie horror role-playing game he published called Fearful Ends, which is fantastic. I've run it myself, even though I don't normally run horror games. And I think our viewers have heard me say a bunch of times that I think that horror is really at the foundation of the Dungeons & Dragons game. And if you look at the Gygaxian literary references that he puts out, the earliest one is Lovecraft. And then the next ones are all people that were connected, that were associated, communicating with Lovecraft, kind of working in that inspiration. For me, my D&D games tend to turn into horror at the end, no matter what I'm trying to do with them. So how important is, am I correct about that? How important is horror to you for your fantasy gaming?
Oh, absolutely. And Paul, I'm so glad to know that you naturally gravitate towards horror too, because I think that it's the root, you know, of suspense. And I personally think that D&D is much more a survival horror game, at least, like, especially in the earlier editions, than people maybe realized. You know, it was fantasy flavored horror. And so for Shadow Dark, that is so intrinsic. It's like you almost can't play the game without there being baked in suspense of like fear of resources running out. And I think that's really crucial to the horror experience, is you need to have this constant feeling of like impending powerlessness. And that is indeed what the Torch Timer is meant to do. So I think it's so crucial. Yeah. I appreciate that you noticed that, Dan.
Like I say, it's just like, oh, this is kind of what the kind of gaming that I'm looking for, frankly. So it's easy to for game to recognize game.
Viewers of last week's live stream will be totally unsurprised, which absolutely ended with a single survivor scraping their way out of the dungeon and us deciding, like, that's it, we're done.
We quit. Sometimes that's what happens. We're gonna retire. No. Oh, that's so funny.
We got our pick in Saj Kant last weekend.
Fun. Is that what you were playing?
We were.
Wow.
I was DMing.
I heard a funny story. Were you? Okay, so that's okay. So yeah. Are you the TPK DM, or is that title shared equally?
I said we're officially planting the flag.
There's an open debate because Dan and I ran an adventure at Rising Phoenix Game Con a few months ago, where we both ran the same adventure with different groups so we could compare notes later. And we had one player who happened to show up to both sessions just because he wanted to. And then he wrote in our Discord, shout out to Ragnar, kind of a comparison, and claimed that I was the tougher DM. And I think anyone who watches last week's live stream knows that that is bunk. Dan is clearly out to get us.
Sorry, Ragnar. Really, it bewildered us when we said that. So yeah, that seemed that seemed correct last weekend.
Oh my gosh. Well, you guys, that's it's fun to have that. They were eaten by ghouls? That's a pretty harsh way to go. They just like drag you off into the darkness and you hear crunching and that's it.
There was some ghoul consumption.
Ghoul consumption. Oh my gosh. This is so cool. Oh my gosh. That's so funny. Well, you guys, so horror stuff, you guys are running Saj Kant. Is this like, do you guys typically run these like old school modules, or how, what made you choose Saj Kant?
Kelsey's flipping this interview on us. What's going on?
I want to know. I'm here to talk. Talking is a two-way street.
You are absolutely right. Yes, indeed.
I know, but I'm sincerely curious.
Dan is particularly trying to refine old school D&D as an original edition. He's got a site, oedgames.com. Definitely check it out. It's just a little concise set of house rules to apply to original edition D&D to make it a little more approachable. Now, I'll call out, though, Dan, like the biggest, and folks who watch our live stream will see this, like the biggest, craziest house rule that Dan has that surprises everyone is no clerics. Absolutely no clerics. They don't exist.
Oh, that's super old school of you. That's like OD&D of you.
It's chainmail of me, right? You go, you like
that's chainmail. Chain right?
Yeah.
Because wait, okay, no clerics turning? Were one of the right. Oh, no turning. Oh, no turning. Holy smokes!
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, no turning, I forget when
no
that.
Feeling. It's rough. It's a difficult. We have
potions in recompense. That's fair. Potions are fair. I feel like, wow. That's scary. Because like I'm like thinking back to the. I don't always remember the order of operations in the very, very early days, like the chainmail transition over into like Blackmoor and then D&D. But I mean, I know Thieves came about later and in the strategic review, I think. I don't. Were clerics
it's
like able to
supplement?
There were clerics.
And Dan likes. Yeah. Dan likes to claim that the thief is the replacement for the broken cleric. You look at like that kind of like pulp fantasy literature that the game comes up out of, the argument is like there aren't really kindly good priests who heal people. That comes from a totally left field space of like old Harryhausen movies. Doesn't really belong in those stories. Usually anyone with a lot of religion in those stories is like horrible evil cultist. So like
true. Oh my gosh, true. Yeah, like I mean I think that I'm not sure how Dave Arneson felt about this, but I know Gary kind of the word on the street is he really didn't like spellcasters, sort of like because in like Conan stories they were always depicted as the bad guy, and I feel like he was trying to embrace that like you know I don't know that worldview, and so wasn't he kind of like annoyed at spellcasters and thought that they were like.
Yeah,
not as cool as fighting men, you know.
in his follow up game, I'm forgetting the follow up game. He also kind of removed clerics because he wasn't happy. I'll also point out this is so weird hearing my own argument back for me from Paul, which is amazing. The very first Fafford in the Grey Mouser story, which is one of the most D&D things I've ever read. They're exploring this haunted tower in the forest, And at some point, this third guy comes in and goes, I'm the holy priest of the great god of protection, and the holy protection will help me survive all these horrors. And one paragraph later, he walks through the next door and gets squashed flat like a pancake. So yes. I feel like that's such holding out. The whole idea is just like, that doesn't work in this world. Sorry, pal.
That is kind of funny. I love, you know, one thing about Shadow Dark, is that, have you guys ever experienced, because you have the whole thing where, especially in trad gaming, like in 5e, there's skill systems and you could, like, anybody can walk up to a door and try to, like, athletics check, kick the door open. And so you get these funny situations where once in a while the barbarian fails and the wizard's like, well, I'll try, and goes and kicks the door open. And I feel like that is now, that's not as much of a thing in Shadow Dark, but really awkward spellcasting failures is a thing. Like, where the wizard is like, I'm going to, like, magically resolve this situation for us, and then they just fail the spellcasting check. So, like, we do have a little bit of that, like, comedic whiplash baked into spellcasting now that I think is, I personally find somewhat funny, but maybe not the person who's trying to cast the spell finds funny.
Let's talk about that. Okay, so casting cast a spell correctly looks to me like an interesting novelty. That's way off any version of D&D. D&D's never had anything like that. Now, I've played a year or two of DCC, and my website is referenced in the rule book, amazingly, so I have a little bit of a soft spot there. Was the role for spell casting inspired by DCC or some other source, or just out of nowhere in your head?
It was somewhat. Also, I think I did see it in DCC, which I think was my first exposure to it. I think it's also in the Black Hack. It's definitely an index card RPG. So I've seen it, like, kind of percolating up out of various places, but as far as I know, the first place I saw it was DCC, and I really love DCC, and I love the way that they handle spell casting. It's very, like, as you guys know, it's very rules heavy reference style, because it has its own set of effects based on how high you roll, and so I didn't want it to be that style for Shadow Dark, so I greatly altered.
I feel like that's a weakness. I feel that's a weakness for DCC, so I would say the exact same thing.
Oh, it's funny, because I think there's the whole fun idea of, like, it kind of makes the player into the wizard, because you're like, I have to reference my arcane tome and, like, see what's happening with this spell, so there's some kind of cool interplay.
Kelsey, I have said this so many times. I have said this so many times about standard D&D that the wizard player needs to have a book in front of them. I'm not kidding, Paul. You've heard me say this a whole bunch of times, right, Paul?
I'm delighted. Exactly. Yep, I've heard it many
times. Oh my gosh, we Dan agree.
Dan has a publication called Book of Spells, which is a rewrite of all of the spells that occur in original edition D&D with the language tried to be fixed up a little bit. If you ever read the original book, some of the spell descriptions are just, my personal favorite is of course the haste spell, I think, which just says, this spell is the opposite of slow. And that's it. That's the whole description.
So easy to interpret. D&D spell. Can I tell you guys one of the strangest things I've learned this year? One of the most interesting things that I feel like I've learned this year in the games industry is, this might be like a really strangely deep cut lore nugget, but do you guys remember when, like, back in the early 2000s, Wizards of the Coast did this contest where they were like, we're going to develop a new in-house world. And in the game, the world that won was Eberron.
Keith Baker.
And so that was being... Yeah, Keith Baker. He's been one of my personal heroes since I was a kid, because it was so exciting to see somebody develop a new official world for the first time. Like, that hadn't happened since, like, the second edition era. So he actually, the whole idea of Eberron came from the fact that he was reading the spell creation rules for third edition. And it was so mechanically intense. Like, I think it was in the DM's guide, it was like rules for making new spells. And he was like, this is so mechanically intense that this implies that magic is in fact a science in the game world. And so because of that, he came up with the whole idea of a sort of science-fueled magical society. And that was the core log line for Eberron. And I was like, that's so crazy. The rules for making a spell were so complex that Eberron happened.
Interesting. Really crazy. I did submit to that competition at the time, Kelsey. And so I have I personally have a big grudge. Oh, it was bullshit. Keith was much
Wait,
better.
What did you
that
like Keith, are you allowed to say
again? Is that why?
Oh no! Is it like a permanent NDA, or do you get to talk about what you developed for it? Is it like permanently? You can never say. Are they keeping it?
Okay. Look. Okay, Kelsey. I see what's happening here. Is Kelsey is trying to flip the script so that she doesn't have to answer the hard questions, right? I warned everybody pre-show that there was going to have to be some hard questions. So here, you're not going to avoid this. Here's the hard question.
Okay, ask a hard one. Okay, yeah.
At the start of your Game Master's book, you have a section on the Pact, which is the part of the core ethos of Shadowdark. And the first sentence that I see there under the Pact is, you and your players are gaming together to have fun, prop each other up, and strengthen bonds. This is the Pact. All decisions to support the Pact are good decisions. Okay, now I do say kind of frequently on this show something along the lines of fun is at least a bit philosophically problematic. And I could say more about that, but I'm going to ask, what is, if fun is the first thing in the Pact, because I hear a lot of different definitions, they vary widely, what is your definition of fun?
Oh, that's such a good question. Somebody once asked me, or like used the usage of fun in that sentence as a very like long, I don't want to say critique, but like philosophical delve into like the core premises of Shadowdark. So for me, I think fun is, it's pretty simple. I find it to be when you guys are mutually enjoying an activity in which everybody gets to meaningfully engage themselves. That for me is what fun would be. It's rooted in enjoyment. Yeah. I didn't think about that for a very long time, so now there might be a philosophical way to dismantle that, which I would love to hear. If you have a rebuttal, I would love to hear it.
Can you have fun in a solo activity? So I just heard, enjoying things together as a group. Can you have fun in a solo activity, or is that out by this definition?
That's a good question. I would have to include it, because I guess it's a group of one in that case. I don't know if group must imply plurality, but I think that, So I guess you could amend it to say like either alone or as a group, depending on whether you're the only person participating or there are other people. If there are other people, I think that you have to like upshift the fun to include those people. You can't just be like, I'm having fun solo playing in a group, because then all the people participating are therefore maybe not having fun then. So,
Let me just hit this for one more beat, right? So I see a lot of different definitions sometimes. Let me just throw two other ones out and see which one feels warmer to you. So in Gygax writing in the first edition DM's guide, he mentions fun very briefly, very rarely. But in the intro, he does say the fun of the game is action and drama, is what he says there. And then secondly, I just happen to be reading a book currently by a guy named Raph Koster, and the book's called A Theory of Fun for Game Design. And for Koster, basically, fun is always learning new patterns. And for Koster, he says, basically, all games are, in some sense, edutainment. Which one feels closer to your sense of fun, Kelsey? Action and drama or learning?
Well, I kind of disagree with the premise that learning is the root of fun. So I think I would have to say the action and drama version. I still think that action and drama are maybe not getting at the root. I think that action and drama are both produced by an underlying level of suspense and pressure. I think that suspense and pressure create action and drama. So I think like, I would personally want to go a layer deeper and try to look at those as the true source of those feelings. But like on balance, I agree that does produce fun. I think that generally produces fun. It can sometimes not though. Like, I don't know, like sometimes it could produce like stress or Yeah, like if you have suspense and the resulting drama, does that always produce fun? Maybe not. Like maybe sometimes, I guess like that's people who enjoy horror movies.
Well, this is my next
question. I think they get a sense of fun. Yeah. Yeah. I can enjoy. Oh yeah, because like, how does it segue into something like horror that some people hate and don't have fun with, and some people do? Because horror's root is suspense, and so, maybe saying action and drama. Maybe drama maybe is a good root for fun because that's like inclusive of different sources of the drama. You know, it isn't always just suspense. I think in the gaming space, for me, it is suspense, but like, drama is maybe a more like umbrella for the different sources of the drama. Yeah. Because like some people like farm sims. I like farm sims. I have fun. Like the drama is like centered around like, am I going to make the field of crops I want by the end of this season? You know, there's like no real suspense there, but it is in a way seeking to find out an answer to an unknown question.
It's funny because the Koster book, I think it's about 20 years old now, but there's a point where he specifically says, nobody makes farming games. That wouldn't be fun. There's no farming games. It takes too long and it's not immediate reaction enough and stuff like that.
The most successful indie title on the planet is a farm sim, you know, like Stardew Valley. It's that's so funny. But there is, this comes from screenplay kind of theory, but the idea of a dramatic question, which is something that I also encountered when I was first like writing for D&D and stuff. It's like the idea of the source of drama is an unanswered question that's worth knowing the answer to. And it's generally a yes or no. Like, are they going to survive? Are they going to get the field of crops they want? Are they going to get married in the end? Like those are yes or no questions. And the point of engaging with the story is to find out the answer. And so that is sort of the screenplay philosophy on where drama comes from. And I think that is a source of fun for people.
Great. That's great. Yeah. I love that, actually. Fantastic.
Yeah.
I did not realize that I'd signed up for Philosophy 101. This is very exciting.
Oh, I don't know anything. Okay, wait. I have one more. For every question I ask, Dan's allowed to ask a hard-hitting question. But, like, do you... I'm making the rules. No, do you guys have like a pet area of like expert, like sort of like something that you're super interested in that you're constantly mining for like, you know, in like gaming inspiration or something you just go back to all the time that's sort of like your pet area of amateur expertise, you know, like something you're really into that only you are into and you find it very useful for your other creative endeavors?
I have a response, but I'll let Paul go first.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, the funny thing, Kelsey, is that Dan and I probably have very different responses. And it's part of the draw of this show in general, is I think our viewers love to see us disagree about stuff. for me, is there something that I go back to? Honestly, like, it's hard for me to think of one thing, and I would just say, like, life in general, as usually when I'm out doing something utterly unrelated to gaming, I'm just in a new space, I'm exploring a new city, I'm trying a new hobby, something clicks in my head and go, oh, I could use that for gaming. And then I immediately want to patch that in.
So you're seeking to experience things that will inspire you. That's kind of,
This is, I mentioned to Dan before, I think that our major a philosophical shift between Dan and I is that I'm looking for like novelty and new experience, and Dan is looking for refinement and expertise. So go, Dan. What's your answer? Let's see if I'm right about my prediction.
Okay, that was a great answer, Paul. Actually, that was actually much better than what I was going to say. So I'm glad you went first. And I will also say that I've said a number of times that for me, you know, D&D is my core game. It's the everything game, and it's the one place where I get to use my brain at full capacity, and it's team building, and it's drama, and it's horror, and it's funny voices, and it's play acting, and it's probability, and it's statistics, and it's history, and it's metallurgy, and it's geography, and it's kind of everything all at once is, you know, why I personally love it so much. I'll say that gaming-wise, my forte, and one thing I was going to ask you about, Kelsey, is does Shadow Dark have any capacity for the old school high-level play then transitions to building a castle, leading an army, mass combat. And more so than Paul, I tend to experiment with these higher level spells or features. I do have, we've for a couple of years here on the channel, we were streaming my Book of War game, which is a streamlined, cut down miniatures war game that I could get my kind of casual gaming friends into play to simulate D&D armies, you know, in battle. So that's certainly the thing that I am mining all the time and, you know, trying to learn more about myself. Does Shadow Dark have the capacity for that, or do you plan to add that, or is that not in the right vein for Shadow Dark?
It's such a good question. It's one I kind of am constantly reevaluating because, like, it actually in the material I'm writing or finishing up right now for the Western Reaches, there is sort of like a soft domain like system incorporated, and it's pulled back enough that it's not meant to turn into like you're building a fiefdom or something. It's like you have at most you could have a castle, and you could trick out the castle and store small standing armies there called warbands. But it kind of stops at the point of becoming like a bookkeeping endeavor. Because the point is that you need to still adventure to supply the resources you have with enough gold. You have to pay your armies and you have to pay to upkeep your castle. And so the only real way to get access to those resources is through individual group adventuring. But I think as soon as you make the jump to like collecting income from your lands or your people, you're suddenly playing domain management. And so Shadow Dark is just right at the precipice of that. And so I think that once the motivation system of the game changes from getting gold to like getting gold through adventuring, then you need to change like the underlying XP systems and all of that as you shift into domain play, because you're trying to motivate different actions and the character's progression should be tied to those things instead. So I don't think Shadow Dark as it is right now is set up to be really able to manage true domain style play. I think that it gets right up to the edge where you become a warlord and then you're like, and now I either retire or I don't know, the GM could try to parlay Shadow Dark into a more domain driven thing, but I haven't personally given much design guidance on that front. So what do you guys think? What do you think turns it into a domain?
I have honestly struggled trying to honor the old school endgame. Paul will advise me that fundamentally you're playing a different game. It's not D&D anymore. So I think that it's wise to be aware of that and not accidentally stumbled into that accident, I guess.
Have you guys ever done, because also I have almost never done, I think I've only played domain management style gaming like once or twice ever, and I think it can be enjoyable, but it just is such a different style to me of
we've experimented
the game at
with
that point.
It a bit. And I think the major discovery here is what Dan is talking about, of like my pushback of it's a different game, is it is a different game. And if you end up with a group who think that they're sitting down to play D&D and then you pull a switcheroo and go, haha, we're doing a domain management game, half of them are going to love it and half of them are going to be like, what is this trash?
Yeah, because it's kind of not what you told them they were going to get from the outset. It's like it's a change. So it's interesting. I wonder, I don't know. It's weird because I think if somebody likes like farm sims and stuff, they would probably like domain management, but I'm not sure that everybody would really. I'm not sure. So few people ever really reach that part of the game.
One of the worst gaming sessions I have personally ever DM'd, I totally stepped into this quagmire of kind of providing both. Of you can go on an adventure, and also I thought there was this, and you also have a domain you're managing. I thought that would take about 15 minutes. But then the six or so players that I had at the table had really different opinions about how to invest their money in the domain. And that got to turn into a really knockdown, drag out argument that lasted for like an hour. Bad on me for not squashing that early on. And boy, I really stepped in and I felt really embarrassed that that had happened. I'm trying to learn that lesson. Don't surprise them.
Oh, no. This does occur. I feel like even as someone who's been GMing for like 25 plus years, I still have players do something where I'm like, well, I let that get way out of hand before I gained control. Like, I'm so guilty of falling into the classic, like, Reddit horror stories, like, do not let your players do this, like, it's gonna destroy your game, and then I, like, it happens, and I'm like, oh no, like, I've completely lost control. It's like, I had, like, oh, just I don't even think, I won't even tell you the story, because I think if the people who heard it, they would know I was talking about them. But suffice to say, I as an experienced game master, still make those kinds of silly mistakes way more than I think.
I don't think I want to call it a silly mistake, because I would call it more of a gamble, because you never know when it is going to pay. Yeah. Right? I think some of the most fun gaming experiences I've had are cases where we absolutely have gone off the rails. And I can think of one particular case of playing a game DM by my brother Max, where he literally had to call the game for 10 minutes and say, I need to sit and think for 10 minutes because I don't know what's going on. Right? And
that was because of me. That was on me. I did that. He gave my character the tactical nuke at the outset. That's why I took the sheet. I was egged on to using it by the other players. I didn't want to use the tactical nuke, but I was egged on by their players, and I said yes, and I nuked the entire adventure site. Yeah. Max, yes, had to reorient the game. Good on him. But that wasn't entirely my fault. The other
players. No, he gave you.
Yeah, I mean, you got to blame Max for putting Chekhov's nuke in the game, right? Like
that. I was just gonna say it's Chekhov's nuke. That's so funny. That's because what does he think? You're not gonna use it? Come on. Yeah. Chekhov's nuke. Oh, it's so true. Wow, it is fun though. It's fun as a game master to like sneak something like that into the game and be like, I have no idea what they're gonna do with this. And then if it actually comes about, you're like, wow. It's I think those are really fun moments as a game master, because you sometimes do have to be like, I need a minute to think this through. But it really is entertaining to have such a large shift in the dynamic. You know,
I think that's the best stuff.
We will always remember that session.
Yeah, it's so memorable. Kelsey, it's so memorable.
Okay, I'm gonna take us on a left turn here a little bit. Yeah. Kelsey, I watched in prep of this, I was watching your deconstructing RPG design video that I think you put out just after Shadow Dark published on Dungeon Masterpiece, where you talked about a lot of like design inspirations of Shadow Dark, which I found really fascinating. Great, great
watch. Oh, yeah! That's fun.
Okay, so I have a specific question, and viewers will forgive me for potentially picking a fight between Dan and Kelsey now. I was fascinated when you mentioned that you had strongly considered a roll under mechanic and chosen to not.
Oh! No! No!
Dan's like, force quit.
Oh my god!
I would love to hear more thoughts on what drove that decision, because it is something that Dan has wrestled with a lot.
It's so tough. It's right. Well, I could say I think that roll under design is very elegant. I think it's very elegant, especially when you're doing like a bell curve stat. You know, like if we're using a 3d6 bell curve stat, the way that it lands is very elegant. What I couldn't get past was, especially like post 2000, like D20 era, like rolling a natural 20 is such a cultural touchstone in D&D likes that having a 20 be a failure to me was insurmountably bad. It just like breaks this sort of too intrinsic connection you have to the die rolls. And so I simply couldn't get past that. Like, and then it was just too awkward to be like, well, but if you roll a 20, that actually is a success and the one is the failure. So we're going to flip it just for those two numbers. It's just like, that gets too fussy. And so like, I decided to make the whole game of Shadow Dark centered around rolling high being good. And you know, having it align more closely with like a derived modifier, trying to hit a DC or AC, which is just a DC. Because it felt more familiar to post D20 era gamers, in my opinion. And part of Shadow Dark is trying to invite like trad gamers into the OSR space. So I was like, I think that's just going to be more understandable to people. And I can't get past failing on a 20. I can't get past it. So that was my thought. What, I don't know, Dan, what is the source of your trauma here?
I mean, I dared not ask the question. I actually wanted to ask you the question. And I put it in my like cut questions section of my notes, frankly, because I dared not say the name. I also think that it should have been roll low at the outset. The all of the D6 rolls in early D&D were roll low for searching, spotting, listening, jumping, all this kind of stuff. I recently wrapped a 2-year campaign of the old school Star Frontiers game, if you know what that is. Roll low percentile, specifically just so that I could enjoy a roll low mechanic for a while, frankly, is the number one reason why I ran it, as a matter of fact. There will be a day, viewers, where I crack and I start running D&D roll low. And I sympathize with Kelsey, like in my house rules, is how much can you change something and still have it be familiar to players? And I feel like for me, I want to come to a convention, I want to be able to tell people I'm running D&D. So for me, there's a lot of things where I feel like that's a bridge too far, that's not going to be recognizable D&D anymore. I feel like with Shadow Dark, you give yourself a little bit more flexibility of, it's technically a different game, and we can make some of these refinements. Like in a couple of things that I noticed in that regard is you've changed some of the terminology, right? So what fifth edition calls inspiration, you call luck. What I'm used to calling spell concentration, you call focus. Were those really easy decisions, or were you worried about those things not being recognizable when you changed them?
Yeah, I did worry a little bit about that, but I also feel like maybe this is just me having been a former 5e designer, but writing out concentration and saying it each time, I was like, this is so annoying. I wanted to call it focus just because it was shorter and easier to say.
As soon as I saw it, I was like, that's a great decision for exactly that purpose. In my book of spells, there's a lot of text there taking up a lot of concentration copies, frankly. And I was like,
it is,
five-letter, what a great choice.
I know, focus, and so I wanted it conceptually to be very similar, but I just wanted it to have maybe like an easier and perhaps more old school tie-in feeling, especially with luck, because I think DCC kind of introduced the concept of luck being a really fun mechanic that I felt really deserved to be present in a more gamified way, you know, because luck is a huge element of like Robert E. Howard stories and Fawford and the Grey Malister stories. Like, luck is like a tangible thing in those stories. And so I wanted to call it something that felt a little bit more cosmic, like inspiration. Luck feels almost like it's something that's outside of your control, whereas inspiration feels like you are the agent in some way in bringing it about. And I was like, oh, that doesn't have the right old school feel to me. I feel like luck just has the better old school feel. Wow, I really went off on a tangent with that. But yeah, I like the terminology of luck better because it implies that you are not necessarily the active agent. It's more like something that happens to you at a cosmic level.
Okay, now I was about to yell heretic at you, just to be clear, because historically, I actually don't like luck mechanics, but you actually made the best defense of that, that I thought was possible, actually. So I'm very warm to your sensibility there. So what I like was reading the rule book. It says, here's the luck mechanic. Honestly, for me, like Inspiration 5th Edition feels like an extraneous add-on that we didn't need. So when I saw the luck rule, I was a little bit surprised in Shadow Dark. I got to the bottom and I said, and it says, well, depending on the theme of your game, you could give up more or less. So if it's a high action pulpy game, you could hand out 2 or 3 or 4 per player. But if you want a gritty, hard hitting game, maybe you don't hand out any. And I'm like, oh, I am officially authorized to not hand out any luck points in a Shadow Dark game. And that's actually canonical. Thank you, Kelsey. How many do you hand out? But Kelsey, how many, where do you land when you run Shadow Dark? How many luck points do you give out?
I'm a notoriously like, I know, right? Hoping for zero. I'm a pro player style game master, and I actually really like pulp style games a lot. So I actually hand out probably a little bit more on average than someone might if they were playing something really gritty. Like, I think the overall themes of Shadow Dart carry grittiness no matter what you do. So I'm okay with being a little heavy on the luck because a lot of times my players need it to survive. Okay. So I'm a little bit more pulpy. I probably give out, like, maybe I would say each player might have two luck tokens at various, like, two total during a session. If I'm, like, running at a convention or something, they probably will earn one if they make me laugh with a really bad joke or something.
I yes. like that as a trigger. I do.
That's I'm like, if you to, make me laugh.
No, it's great. Great. I want to jump back to the question Dan was poking at a little bit about, you know, the issue of deviating too far from D&D and can you still call it D&D and using mechanics players associated with. I think it's especially pertinent when we're talking about, like, building bridges between OSR and modern gamers, because the term there is different terminology in the different sets, and, like, how do you bring people in? Was any of that in your brain when you included advantage and disadvantage? We've had a lot of debates about advantage disadvantage on this channel. There's a certain elegance to the mechanic on one hand, but on the other hand, I feel like the contrary argument is, like, it makes it harder to predict actual, like, statistical probability. Where do you land?
It does. Like, so is it the question kind of like, did I decide to keep those elements to make it more D&D like, or was it like, because in a way,
it in there because you wanted something a little more 5e feeling, or do you just love advantage, disadvantage? Why is it present? That's what I want.
That's such a good question. I actually really just like it as a mechanic, like, full stop. And it does make it a little harder to calculate success probabilities accurately because it changes depending on what the target number is, you know? Like, it's harder to, it results in, like, an average of either a +3 or a +5 bonus depending on what the target number is that you're trying to hit in total. If I recall the math on that, but I think that it's just, I think that granular bonuses, unless there's something flat that permanently modifies something you're rolling so you don't have to constantly remember it, I think that they're really kind of fussy and annoying to keep track of. And one of the gameplay styles for Shadow Dark I was looking for was, like, instant feedback on a result, which is why we have standardized DCs that are player facing. You know, like, I don't want you to, like, roll and then have to spend 15 seconds, like, tabulating bonuses and then ask the game master what the DC was. You know, like, you should be getting feedback from the result instantaneously, linked into your experience very strongly. So that's why I felt advantage was a better way of providing a bonus than a granular +1 or +2 or whatever.
Do you then, when playing, announce the armor classes of the monsters at the beginning of a fight?
I announce it almost immediately. I do, because it ties into the fact that I want players to be able to tell me if they're successful instead of me, like, you know, there's this, you get more excitement when the player can just be like, I hit, you know, instead of being like, I got this number, did I hit? And then you're like, there's no fun way to deliver it that could be more fun than the player celebrating it in the second.
I have made the same argument recently, Kelsey. I'm so glad to hear this from somebody else. Partly my play of Star Frontiers refined, right, highlighted how important that is, that you don't need the DM to tell you. You can just see objectively from the die, and we can all celebrate or mourn, you know, from the Oracle. And as an aside, this is one of my arguments for Roll Low, is you can do all the adjustments in advance, have the target number, roll the die, and be done with it. And for many years, I think I overlooked how important that instant recognition was. And just in the last couple of years, I've come around to, like, how really critically important that is. What a great observation.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. It's funny. I think that it's a lot, and you guys are picking up on this, which I'm so impressed by, but a lot of decisions in Shadow Dark went into reducing the amount of downtime calculating to get to the result faster. So, you know, there's no real negative math in Shadow Dark, specifically because there's a lot of data that shows that people are 1.5 times to 2 times slower at mentally subtracting than they are at adding. And so, like, the amount of lag that creates, like, obviously it's simple math. Like, people aren't dumb. Like, they can subtract, but it results in enough additional lag time and calculation that it kind of robs the moment of its drama.
Two of us have said this on the show, Kelsey. Now there are, thank you, because now that the number of people who just said that psychological fact on the show has doubled from one to two. So I really appreciate that.
To bring it back around, right? I think, Dan, that's Dan's argument for why he prefers low roll, or roll under, rather. Yeah. Right? That it is immediate feedback when the dice hit the table about whether or not
you it is. It's actually the best. Right. I think it is like the most elegant version of action resolution, apart from the cultural I rolled a nat 20 thing that for me basically overruled it, even though I feel it's superior design in every way. It is, that's otherwise important. Yeah, that's important.
Mm-hmm. Let me just ask a follow-up about the specific fixed DCs that you use. So one of our patrons on our Discord server a week or two back, and I apologize because I can't remember who said it, pointed out that the specific DCs you've got, which are 9, 12, 15, 18, if you convert them they convert very nicely to D6s, is you can basically divide by 3, and if you did that on a D6, the targets would be 3, 4, 5, 6. And of course, all those skills in traditional D&D, again, the listening, searching, spotting, opening a trap, whatever, were all done on a D6. Was the fact that your targets could be resolved on a D6 perfectly fine? Was that intentional? Was that a happy accident?
I think that is really a coincidental happy accident, because those numbers were originally derived from trying to maintain an average of like a 65% success rate based on what someone's stats would be, at low levels. So at third level and below. Because again, like, it's funny, I have to thank Wizards of the Coast for doing a lot of, you know, data-driven research into like what players find fun and interesting, and sometimes sharing that information, because they, in a lot of their playtesting, found that you need around a 65% average success rate to keep players kind of happily engaged, because too much failure is actually not fun for people, and then too much success is a cakewalk. So like, they found that to be about the happy medium, and ended up designing that array of DCs around that purpose.
Fascinating. Okay. Yeah. I wouldn't have done that.
Clever. Yeah. But it's cool that it worked out to D6 derived stuff pretty easily as well. That's I wish I could say I was smart enough to have planned that, but alas, I was not.
Please, in future interviews, change your answer.
Yeah. I'm like, the secret is this. It's all D6s in reality. I only play Shadow Dark with D6s. Yeah. Yeah. That's so funny. That's it's cool though.
So funny.
Maybe you should try it. Oh my gosh. So is it Dan, I was gonna try to make some joke about how like I've successfully fulfilled the script you gave me about agreeing with all of your most deeply held game beliefs, and that we're planning to discredit Paul. This was our secret plot. Everything we're saying is
challenging interviews. Kelsey, you're a challenging interview subject. You might possibly take the cake for most challenging interview subject of just being slippery and trying to turn around on us and making me look bad right at the end. So noted.
No, I think it's so funny. But I love that you two have sometimes differing viewpoints on these things, because that's why we have so many games. You know, there's no one right way to do or design this stuff. And if there were, then we'd only have the one game. And thankfully we don't. So it's very diverse.
Belying the earlier argument. Kelsey's clearly on my side. More games, more variety, more different experience.
No, I'm not. That's not what I'm hearing. I'm hearing surprises when we play slightly odd variants of D&D is what I'm hearing.
It's so, and I think it's interesting because I don't know, Paul, I don't know where you fall on this spectrum, but I've always been very, very like grabbed by the Dungeons and Dragons experience. Like, I wouldn't say I'm like a D&D purist, but I don't often go outside the D&D like space, because for me, that's just like, that's what I'm always seeking. And so like, I've love and have played games that are not D&D games, but it's always just a quick visit for me. I'm never going to like run a campaign like that. So I don't know if like, Paul, you seem a little bit more like you'd be comfortable like running like long games in other systems that you're not just like anchored to D&D.
I, I ran a long Deadlands campaign once. I'm currently running a quest RPG game.
Okay.
I do always return to D&D. D&D is the nice, safe, happy space that I can come back to and go, oh yeah, this. Also, I think thematically, I tend to prefer fantasy settings. Unlike Dan, I don't spend a lot of time in sci-fi space. I've never felt the compulsion to get out there and run. What is the game you just ran, Dan? Star Frontiers.
Yeah, Star Frontiers.
Star Frontiers. Is it, Dan, are you more like I'm comfortable existing for long stretches outside of D&D like space? Are you more like that's okay for you?
I would happily say that I'm a D&D purist. I do have a soft spot for that old Star Frontiers campaign. It's a great campaign out of the box. My players thought that it was going to have a bunch of cringy 80s content, and then they wound up falling in love with all the different alien races on this wilderness planet. And I did want to have an excuse for a roll low mechanic that did really make my numbers brain a lot happier, frankly. But D&D is my number one thing, no doubt.
Yeah.
All right. I have on time, unfortunately, at this point. We are approaching the top of the hour here. Kelsey, I just want to throw it to you really quick and say, is there anything about Shadow Dark that we missed or any other message you want to give to our viewers here before we run out of time?
Oh, well, thank you to everyone who supported the Western Reaches Kickstarter and the fact it's been a little bit delayed because we're having a baby. I'm not pregnant, my wife's pregnant, but we've been having to push things back a little bit because that's been so deeply involved. But I really appreciate people sticking by me through that. And it's in writing, it's underway, we're making great progress. And then I guess the other thing I wanted to mention is that I know that if some of you are familiar with my work, that Professor Dungeon Master is about to release like a kind of Shadow Dark, I don't want to call it a hack, but it's like a compatible with Shadow Dark system of his own called Deathbringer. He's literally releasing it on Tuesday, and he's a good friend of mine. So full disclosure, Dan has become a very good friend of mine since I published Shadow Dark. I didn't know him before that, but then afterwards, yes. So I'm always going to love his stuff, but it's genuinely so cool. And I think it's a landmark moment in Shadow Dark history to have a really big, basically fully compatible system coming out from another creator of Dan's magnitude. And so I just wanted to say I'm so excited for that. And that's literally launching on Tuesday, the 15th, I think, is the date, or the 14th. What day even is it? I don't know. Yeah, 14th. So that's the cool stuff that's happening in the Shadow Dark space right now.
Awesome.
Amazing.
Awesome. Viewers definitely go take a look at that. Highly recommend. And if you haven't, grab yourself a copy of Shadow Dark. Great RPG. I've mentioned many times on this show recently that I'm looking forward to starting a campaign of it fairly soon. So I'm sure I'll have more to say on this channel about it as we progress. Viewers, if you have thoughts, questions, concerns, anything you want to know about Shadow Dark or experiences you've had playing it, please leave us a comment here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe that'll spawn a new conversation for Dan and I down the road.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. We are on YouTube and Twitch and Facebook and TikTok and Loops and GitHub and places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there and make sure to smother that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can find that on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also through various third-party carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those sites and it gives the ability to do so, please consider leaving us a 5-star review. That helps other viewers, other listeners on that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do, and of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, and like Paul said at the top of the hour, every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation is continuing around the clock 24/7 about old school games and new school games and horror games and miniatures and war games and all the stuff that we love. And we do have the most intelligent patrons, the wisest patrons, the most charismatic patrons in all the land. So you can go there, ask your troubling, tough gaming questions, and they're going to have some great ideas for solutions on our Discord server. We'll be there in about 10 minutes to continue this chat there in our live video after chat. And Kelsey, can we get you to drop in for a couple minutes maybe to answer some questions?
Absolutely. I'm crashing it.
Amazing. I have some other questions that I didn't get in the hour because Paul cut me off, just to be perfectly clear. So Kelsey, your time is so valuable. We cannot thank you enough for jumping on with us. We've just had a blast with you here, and we hope we can get to you again sometime in the future.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. It's been so fun to talk to you. You guys are just so cool, and I greatly appreciate you letting me come on here. So thank you.
Our pleasure, our treat. Thank you so much for your time. So viewers, don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.